From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. I'm Michael Schaefer, sitting in for Kojo. Today on our show, in theory, Thanksgiving shouldn't make anyone nervous about getting every dish just right. It's a holiday about family and plenty, not about beautiful plating. All the same, let's admit it. It's become a day when a lot of us wind up trying to impress everybody by deploying the absolute perfect recipe. But here's the thing. These days, the very idea of recipe has changed. The old-fashioned recipe, you know, the one with step-by-step instructions on how to cook something, it ain't what it used to be. And in the digital kitchen, powered by GIFs and web videos and smart devices, the written recipe is not your only option either. It's Food Wednesday, and we're looking at the new ways recipes are being presented, from quickie online videos to scientific explanations. Joining me in studio is Bonnie Benwick, the deputy editor and recipe editor at the Washington Post food section. From KQED studios in San Francisco, Kenji Lopez-Alt. He's the managing culinary director at Serious Eats and the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. And Kim Severinsen is in Atlanta, where she is the bureau chief at the New York Times. She just wrote a really cool article about how cookbooks, like just about everything else in the media, are being disrupted here in the 21st century. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
And you can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. Now, Kim, your article was headlined, Written Recipes Undergo a Modern Makeover. Can you describe this makeover? How did they used to look and how do they look now?
Well, recipes and cookbooks in particular have a long history of transforming culture. And, you know, we can even go back to when the Fanny Farmer and the Boston Cooking School started, and they started to actually add things like one teaspoon instead of a spoonful, and they started to really make things seem more scientific. So there was a sense of a real formulaic way of producing recipes that were uniform, that you could replicate. Those eventually got translated into or sort of more modern cookbooks and things like The Joy of Cooking, and certainly food media and newspapers and magazines, at least back in the day. So you had this form of writing recipes that was fairly standardized so everyone could do it. And as more people came into the cooking world and we got through the, food revolution in the 80s and the 90s, and certainly the network food television generation, this idea of making recipes everybody could be a part of made recipes fairly simple and fairly standardized in some circles. But now what we've got going on are recipes. People are into food in ways they haven't been before. It's the cultural currency of our time. And you have a lot of people coming at food in lots of different ways. So you have food bloggers who might take you through their long, you know, interested in extended journey about how they screwed up a recipe and then found the perfect solution, and then their dog ate it, and then this is how they're feeling about their husband. And, you know, you have these long, rambling narratives in recipes. You have people, and Kenji certainly a key example. You have people who are really understanding the science behind recipes and really taking them and drilling down, blowing them up, presenting them in different ways. We've got people doing recipes as graphic novels. You have people, even for a while when Twitter started, people were getting into the idea of, could you do recipes in 140 characters? So the Twitter recipe was a bit of a fad for a minute. So there are all different ways that people are coming at recipes, and this is not even talking about how you can click on YouTube and figure out how to braid challah bread. So we're really seeing a disruption, if you will, and a democratization of recipes. But at the same time, the literary form, the narrative joy of reading a cookbook is getting some new legs.
All right, so it's about to be Black Friday. What are some cookbooks out there on the market that represent this?
Oh, well, I gotta give a shout out to Kenji Lopez-Alt's book, it's called The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and I think that's got a lot of appeal. And there's books like that. There are these really lovely narrative books. Ruth Reichel's book about her sort of coming back to life through cooking is a kind of a lovely narrative read that I think people are into. The Camino cookbook out of San Francisco kind of is that Judy Rogers sort of long explaining, you know, 8 paragraphs to tell you how to grill bread and how you should feel about it, and in this kind of lovely sensibility. There are hundreds and hundreds of cookbooks out there right now, and I'm sure that everybody could find one that they like. You know, it depends on what you have. Do you have a millennial person who's in, just wants to learn how to make, you know, Korean tacos, that whole genre of the 101 easy Asian recipes, the kind of idea of folks who are taking, you know, traditional foods and turning them on their heads and kind of making them as inauthentic as they possibly can for fun. And there's a wide range. Who do you want to buy a cookbook for is the question.
So there's also this book called Dirty Candy, which is the name of a New York restaurant. And it's both a graphic novel and a cookbook. Is this kind of genre bending a common thing now?
That really did blow things up. And I think Gabrielle Hamilton's cookbook Prune, she owns a restaurant in New York City. Those books that really are sort of little journeys into the restaurant in ways that are not, you know, just a sort of traditional, like Thomas Keller kind of Bible style book. Those are really kind of cool. If you think about it, you know, you look at Dirty Candy, and she just wanted to kind of tell you how it felt in the restaurant. And they had this idea to do graphic illustration instead of real straight ahead recipes. I think that book has been very popular, selling very well.
Kim Saverson is the Atlanta bureau chief at the New York Times, and I'm also talking with Bonnie Benwick. She's the deputy editor and the recipe editor at the Washington Post food section. So Bonnie, there's like a billion recipes available on the internet. Are people still buying cookbooks?
I've been told and I've seen lots of evidence online, you know, surveys that say there's a certain sector of the population, let's say in Britain, it's women under 25, don't really buy cookbooks like they used to. I think it's down quite a bit. But the overall, you know, there are a billion recipes online, but as Kim and Kenji can both attest, there are not a billion good recipes online. I mean, it depends on, you're talking about a source. A trusted source. You know, I spoke at a couple of classes at University of Maryland just a few weeks ago, and it was a food writing class, and I asked them where they got their recipes online. Everybody raised their hands, and they got recipes online, not out of cookbooks, everybody who was looking at them. But then they were very quick to chime in and say, when I drilled a little bit, they said, you know, well, it didn't really work, and I had to do this, and I had to do that. And then I read 300 comments that told me that, you know, how I could substitute different things. And it's a little, you know, it's like, how much time do you want to spend? You know, chances are it's going to be edible, but is that how you want to spend your time with any particular so-called quick and easy dish that you're making for dinner? So,
although I have to say, if these were University of Maryland students, when I was in college, pre-web recipes, I managed to screw up a lot of things that were actually published by publishing houses.
that may be. So, but these people had slow cookers. They're past the packets of ramen noodle stage. I mean, they're looking online. They're interested in food. I mean, there is, you know, like Kim said, there's just this very broad interest. But in the broad interest, you've got a broad audience. So they really bring their own kind of cooking talents to the table. And let's say some people will understand terminology. Some people won't. Some people really need to have their hands held. Some people who've been cooking for 50 years, you know, get all the references, and maybe they want the context. I mean, I tweeted earlier, like, gee, wonder where Bonnie's going to come down. Does she like cookbooks, or are they dead? You know, they're not dead. And I don't think they're going to be. I mean, that narrative that Kim spoke about, it is that context of a recipe, the sort of, when I was testing out of Ruth Reichel's book that Kim wrote so nicely about, I found that she just reveled in those little touches. And when she would say, you know, I've got my hands on this and it feels a certain way, or it made me feel good, or it smelled up my house like something fierce, you know, I love stuff like that. I have them on my bedside table.
My sense of cookbooks also, and maybe it's just this commercial time of the year, is that they have become much more beautiful books, that these are like objets that you want to keep in your house and show off rather than plain old utilitarian books.
Well, food photography is really amazing. I mean, you know, Kim's former buddy, Amanda Hesser, who used to be at the New York Times, is her Food 52 site, you can look at the simplest recipe, and they've got that lighting down. They don't have a big, huge studio. They're doing it in natural light in a very small way. But, you know, everything looks a lot better. Everything looks a lot better, and it helps you want to make it. You know, there are lots of cookbooks that are out there that I grew up with that didn't have a single picture in them. And do I think the visuals really help you want to make it and tell you what it's going to look like? Yes, I do. So I tend to gravitate toward cookbooks with recipes and photos. That said, you know, something like Kenji's fabulous book, you know, it's got a lot more words than recipes. And a lot more words than pictures, I mean. Sorry.
Kenji
well,
Lopez.
We'll see you now on Amazon, Kenji. We're going to sell you a lot of books today.
Sure. Like he needs,
it does
like
actually
he needs
have
that.
A lot of...
Kenji Lopez Alt is the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. It's a really cool book. And Kenji, I think one of the changes we're seeing is that instead of the sort of step-by-step instructions that you'd have in The Joy of Cooking, a lot of people are more writing about why, the science, the craft, rather than here's 8 steps to make a certain kind of soup. Is that what you're doing?
Well, yes, it is. You know, my book is, I mean, it's 1,000 pages, but it only has fewer than 300 recipes, which is, I think, 20 times less recipes per page than The Joy of Cooking had. you know, so it is. It's really much more about the essays leading up to the recipes. And the idea, and I think this is an especially appealing way to write for, you know, people who are scientifically minded or people who are into engineering, is that once you understand sort of the ins and outs of cooking and the basics and the science behind it, then the recipes almost become superfluous, you know. And that's really the idea behind the book. You know, the recipes are meticulous. And if you go and look at, say, like a magazine like Cooks Illustrated or any of their books, their recipes are also very meticulous. But the important part is the writing that leads up to it, which explains why you're doing things a certain way in a recipe. Because, you know, once you understand what's going on in the recipe, that sort of frees you up to take the recipe in whatever direction you want, you know, with a bit more confidence, knowing that what you're changing is not going to alter or is not going to impede the end result or not going to make the recipe totally fail.
Explain that a little bit. Why is the recipe superfluous once you have learned technique?
Well, you know, I like to think of science as sort of like a roadmap, or you know, if you look at like a Google map and you're zoomed way out, and you know that, okay, I'm driving from Boston to New York, and I know that New York is kind of south of Boston. When I'm totally zoomed out, I can see maybe the major highways, and that's like sort of what, you know, a basic recipe gets you. It gets you one route from point A to point B. But you know, the closer you zoom in on that, and the more you understand about the nuances and the little twists and turns in the road, and the sort of side trips you can make, you know, that's when you can decide, okay, you know what, I'm gonna pull over in Connecticut and stop at this hot dog stand, or maybe get a slice of pizza because now I see this on the map. And you know, and maybe at the end you decide, you know what, I don't really want to go to New York. I want to go to DC instead. And so understanding the road is what allows you to have the confidence, you know, to stray from the main path and take your own and choose your own path, really. It's the same with recipes. Once you understand why you're doing things a certain way, it gives you the confidence and it empowers you as the cook to stray from the recipe. Because, you know, a restaurant chef, they don't, you know, when they're creating new recipes, coming up with new dishes, they don't do things by rote. They don't follow directions from A to B. You know, they have a set of techniques. They understand the interactions between food and energy, and the basic chemistry and physics behind it. And drawing on that information, you can then decide what route you want to take.
Have you read The Food Lab? Did you find the scientific explanations behind cooking useful? We would love to hear from you. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. You can also get in touch via social media on our Facebook page or tweet us at Kojo Show. Kim Severson, you have written a lot about the sort of intersections of food and culture. And I get the sense there is this sort of technique-first movement afoot. What are the roots of this movement?
That's interesting. I remember a time, I was just talking to somebody about this, when Thomas Keller's French Laundry cookbook came out, and people really were feeling like they wanted to cook more complexly. There was an interest among people who didn't have, like, dinner to put on the table for kids every night, younger people to cook. So people would spend weekends trying to make Thomas Keller's, you know, I mean, he has a Caesar salad recipe that takes you 3 days to make. You know, you have to you know, kind of do these kind of special Parmesan crackers, and you have to do... So people were spending their weekends trying to do these really elaborate chef-driven recipes, and you all may connect me, but it seems like in the early 2000s there was this real sense of ambition in cooking and this idea of, like, let's really drill down deep. And I think you have a couple of things going on. You have a little bit of the rise of the DIY culture of people wanting to, you know, it's a digital culture and things became intangible and we were all sort of not connecting. We were connecting digitally and not in person. There was a rise in people who wanted to do things with their hands and wanted to make things, the makers movement and, you know, sort of industrial feel to a lot of the clothes that we had and music even to a degree. So I think the rise of wanting to cook more complexly and to be in the kitchen with just singular focus on a dish that you were making as a thing, have their antecedents in those kinds of movements. So there's been this real sense of wanting to do science, although, you know, we all have to give props to Harold McGee, who wrote a really popular book about food science, and people were starting to learn more about that. So I think as a culture, we wanted to cook better, and so people wanted to learn more about the whys. And then I think you had this this desire to be in the kitchen and to have something real and tangible in your hands. You know, we saw for a little while the rise of preserving bread books and preserving books, although you talk to any cookbook seller now, and they'll tell you the canning and preserving boomlet that happened maybe a year or 2 years ago in books is completely dead now. You can't sell a preserving book to save your life. So these things come in waves, you know. I think there's also, though, something to be said for a really good recipe that works and that you don't have to necessarily have to learn the technique terribly, because a lot of people do want to jump into the kitchen on one or two nights a week. They're not cooking every night like they families used to. You know, there's so many different ways you can get food now. And when people cook, they want to cook, and they want to cook well, and they, I think, are fairly articulate about how they are agile in the kitchen. But they want to be able to go to a recipe, have it work, and it can even be a little bit complex, but maybe not have to spend all their time learning the technique necessarily. I mean, once you make a recipe two or three times, you can start to get it. But I think a lot of people want to be able to pull a book off the shelf or maybe go online, have it be reliable and tested and work. They're not investing a lot of time, you know, not spending a lot of time in the kitchen going over recipes two or three times. So the first time they grab it, they want it to work. And so I think that's where we're getting, you know, there's still a really good market for a recipe that may be sophisticated in some technique and in some tastes and flavors, but that works well and where they can just rely on, I can turn to that page. I don't have to spend all my time learning exactly the ins and outs of, you know, searing tomatillos. Just tell me how to do it. I want to make this good recipe tonight and move on. So I think there is the importance of recipes that work really well, because there are so many out there, are becoming, you know, that is a huge value, which is why we're seeing really reliable cookbooks still very popular. I talked to Christopher Kimball, who's the America's Touch Kitchen founder, and his line is, you know, if you don't think you need a good source for your recipes, or you don't think you need a well-tested recipe, type broccoli casserole into Google, make the first one that comes up, and it will be lousy, I promise you. So you really do need to know who is putting your recipes together and going to a trusted source, and that's why I think sort of branded recipes that come from some place that people can rely on. We like to think at the New York Times we're one of those, and I'm sure my colleagues will want to weigh in as well.
Bonnie is rolling her eyes.
I am not.
No, I think that traditional food magazines and food media are really important, because there is a cadre of food editors and cookbook editors out there who care very deeply about you know, going over recipes several times, testing them several times, making sure that what we present to the readers works. You know, I always argue in our shop that, you know, recipe writing is journalism as much as reporting on the Afghan war is. I mean, it's got to work. It's got to be reliable.
Word,
to be well sorted.
Mm-hmm. And that. Kim Severson mm-hmm. is the Atlanta Bureau Chief at the New York Times. Kenji Lopez-Alt is the Managing Culinary Director of Serious Eats. He's also the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. And Bonnie Benwick is the Deputy Editor at the Washington Post Food Section. We will continue our conversation about just what a recipe means in 2015 after the short break. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. I'm Michael Schaefer from Washingtonian, sitting in for Kojo.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Hear are the stories of these incredible scientists, activists, artists, and more throughout February on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at WAMU.org.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Schaefer, sitting in on the Kojo Namdi Show. I am talking with Bonnie Benwick, the deputy editor of the Washington Post Food Section, Kim Severson from the New York Times, and Kenji Lopez-Alt, the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. Kenji, in your new book, The Food Lab, it has, I think, an appropriate title. And you, in this book, treat the kitchen like a science lab. What kind of experiments did you include? How do they teach readers to be better cooks?
Well, you know, the Better Home Cooking Through Science thing is, so, I mean, it's sort of tongue in cheek. You know, it's not sort of the big word lab coat kind of science. Science is just a way of looking at the world around you and categorizing it and trying to understand it better and looking at it sort of in an ordered way to make sure that you can repeat your results. And that's really all I'm doing in that book. So it could be anything as simple as salting scrambled eggs and seeing how long it takes, how long before you cook them you should salt them, if you should salt them at all before you cook them. You know, so what I would do is maybe take three dozen eggs, scramble them with salt at 5-minute intervals, starting from, 0 minutes before I cook them up to a day before I cook them, and then cook them all side by side and see which one, and see how that affects the texture, see how that affects moisture loss. And so by doing really simple experiments, and the idea is that they're all, I'm doing these in my home kitchen, and they're all experiments that people can do at home. If they don't trust my results, if you don't trust my results, you can repeat the experiment at home and see for yourself. And that's sort of the idea behind it. It's that, science doesn't have to be about big words. It doesn't have to be, modernist cuisine style science, which is also great science, but quite a different style. It can be, the point of science is that, it helps you understand the world, and it doesn't really have a motive. It helps you do whatever you want to do, just in a slightly more orderly way. By using science, you can figure out what the best way to peel an egg is. And there's a lot of these sort of questions, like how to peel an egg, or when is the best time to sear a steak, or when should you salt a steak, and all these questions that people have opinions on. And in the past, often those opinions were based on really nothing more than maybe what your chef or what your grandmother told you. But with science, you can actually answer those questions. So you can actually see for yourself that if you sear a steak after you bring it up to temperature, as opposed to searing it right at the beginning, that the steak will actually retain more moisture. Or that if you drop your eggs into boiling water instead of bringing them up slowly in cold water, that the shells will stick to them less. They'll be able to peel better. That's the kind of experiment I'm talking about in that book.
So you say science doesn't have a motive, but I think a lot of people who read 1,000 pages of your book do have a motive, which is to become a better cook. Are these experiments that you're talking about in the book going to give them those tools?
Well, yes, it's going to answer a lot of the questions that people have, and everybody has questions when they're cooking, and this is something that I discovered when I first started working in restaurants. I would always have questions. I'd be like, why are we frying these French fries twice? And if it's really because you want the fries to cook through the first time and then crisp up the second time, why do we have to fry them the first time? Why can't we say boil them or steam them the first time? And the answer is usually, well, we don't have time to answer questions like that, or time to figure that out. Just do it the way it's written because it works, And for most people, that's good enough. If I've tried a recipe and this is the way I was taught to make it and it works, that's good enough. But I find, and I think a lot of other people, especially I think more people are cooking these days, and different types of people are cooking these days than used to. So I think a lot of people, and a lot of the sort of younger generation, they're not content with just doing things the way that they were told to do. They want to have a little bit more control over the end results. And you can't really get control over the end results until you understand the process that's leading you there. The idea with the book and with doing science in the kitchen is that, someone like me whose job it is to do this thing, I do a lot of those experiments for you so you can see my results. And with science, it's always important to show your results. So, you know, you do that by showing photos, side-by-side photos, or really detailed paragraphs explaining what happens if you do things two different ways or three different ways. And, you know, once you see those results, that's sort of where the authority in a story comes from. It's not really about the name of the chef behind it. It's not really about... you know, a celebrity endorsing it, it's the results are there, and you can't really argue with them, especially if you can repeat them for yourself at home.
All right, so one section of this book is called How to Make Creamy Vegetable Soups Without a Recipe. Is your ultimate goal
right
here to in the food lab to get people to learn how to cook without instructions?
Yes. I mean, very much so. You know, I can tell you that, you know, that book has several hundred recipes, but I don't use a single one of them when I'm cooking at home. I use a lot of the ideas that I developed while I was working on those recipes, but I don't pull out that book and look up the recipe. Like when I want to make fried chicken, I don't use the exact recipe in that book. I use the ideas that came across with it, but I'll fudge around with the seasonings. I might try different sized pieces of chicken, or a few weeks ago, I did, you know, chicken fried shrimp with a very similar approach to the breading and the frying stages, but a completely different set of flavors and obviously a different protein. So, you know, it really is a book of techniques. And I think if you look at the types of people who are cooking these days, that is what a lot of people want. It's the reason why, you know, videos like, you know, watching Jacques Pepin make an omelet on YouTube, or watching, you know, Gordon Ramsay's 30-second videos about how to cook a steak, they don't give you any precise measurements. They don't really give you any precise timings. They just show you the basics of the technique behind something. And I think that's how a lot of people want to cook.
And listeners can read an excerpt from the Food Lab about creating the perfect boiled egg. And you can also find Kenji's recipe for cooler-cooked olive poached salmon at kojoshow.org.
This is like an infomercial. I'm really getting, digging it.
I know. I feel like I need to come up with something to sell really quickly. Kim,
you and I should do a book, and then we'll get Kenji to talk about it.
Right. Looks like talking about recipes on the radio, a how-to guide. There you go.
It is a great
for
book.
Thanksgiving? This is my question. What techniques are you doing this Thanksgiving that are unusual or different or anything new you've learned from books?
I would actually love to hear that from all listeners. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or by sending an email to kojo@wamu.org. Christina in Rockville has been holding, and she wants to talk about a cookbook that is was published a long time before Kenji's.
Yes. Hi, this is Christiana, and I'm just here in the middle pre-cooking for Thanksgiving because I have to work tomorrow. But my favorite book is from 1970. It's called The Tassajara Bread Book.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
I remember that book. I have that book.
You guys have been writing, talking about, it tells you about the ingredients and their characteristics and how they behave. So it gives you an understanding. And then when you actually start touching your first yeast and making it into a dough, all that, how it feels and how you might relate to it, all of that is included too. And my favorite part in it is also, it says, what if you don't have an ingredient in your kitchen? So what can you do if you don't have the eggs or you don't have this kind of shortening or so? So I learned from that book a whole different way of cooking than how I grew up. I learned from that book to have a theme and then make variations, like jazz, you know?
I think that's a good way to think of it. And, you know, I remember having similar thoughts about, you know, James Beard and his bread books and what all was involved in that. I mean, people were sort of in their own ways doing a little bit what Kenji's done, you know, brought into modern times. They were explaining the whys and wherefores and lots of permutations and the whole thing about, you know, when Kenji cooks or when Kim cooks, you know, they've got a whole lot of knowledge in their heads. They've, you know, they've got muscle memory in the kitchen even. They know what they're doing and they can riff on things. You know, I found just today when I was making these tarts that I've been making for 25 years, cranberry tarts, that I brought some into the studio today. But I just decided that the recipe, as simple as it was, if I, you know, did a couple of different things based on, you know, tips and techniques I've learned from, you know, pastry chef friend, and you know that I could probably make them a little easier and better, and sure enough I did. So Yeah, I looked back at the original recipe. I found that probably for the last 5 years, I've just been leaving an egg out of the filling. Like, it just dropped from my memory. So I looked that up. I put that back in today. And with a couple of tips, I think I made them better than I have in a long time. So,
Adrian in South Riding, Virginia, has been holding for an awfully long time. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm so excited about this book. I've been looking for a book like this forever. While I was holding, I was thinking, I grew up a latchkey kid, and my mom used to buy me cookbooks so I could make food for my brothers and sisters. And I think in that way, cooking and following the recipe and following the instructions and hoping that it came out right exposed me to science. I love science. I went on to get a biology degree, and now I'm an ICU nurse. And on the other side, it made me a recipe cook, and I'm a very good recipe cook, but I'm always very afraid to veer from the recipe because I don't understand the foundation of the recipe. I don't understand the science behind it, and I'm always still that's missing. And if I run out of something, I find myself I have to go to the store to get that exact ingredient because I'm scared. So I can't wait to read this book because I think it's going to bring me full circle from recipes introducing me to science back to the science reintroducing me to the kitchen so I can be a better cook. And I just can't wait to get this book. Thank you so much for writing it.
Thanks.
Kenji, that's I believe funny, she's talking about you.
That's actually the sort of opposite route that I took because I started as a biology major in college, then started working in restaurants. And it was in restaurants where I was like, you know, there isn't enough science here. And that sort of brought me back to doing to putting the two together and doing science and food together.
And we'll continue our conversation about recipes in 2015 after this break. I'm Michael Schaefer from Washingtonian, and you're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. Welcome back. I'm Michael Schaefer, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. I'm talking with Kim Severson, who is the Atlanta bureau chief at the New York Times and writes a lot about food and culture, with Kenji Lopez-Alt, the managing culinary director at Sirius Eats and the author of The Food Lab, and with Bonnie Benwick, who's the deputy editor at the Washington Post food section. Bonnie, the website BuzzFeed launched Tasty at the end of July. Now, this is a site. It creates short, one-minute or less videos of hands quickly creating easy dishes. Its Facebook page, I believe, already has about 12 million likes. How do you explain this?
There's a lot of visual learners out there. It takes, maybe 8 seconds to show something that might take 200 words to explain. And I think they're kind of beautiful. I've seen really nice versions of those, and I like looking at them as much as I like looking at really nice pictures of food that go along with recipes. So it's just another way of getting it and getting to see it. It's what I thought was kind of interesting a couple years back. Kim, correct me if I'm wrong. There were these little e-books. You were supposed to put your iPad right on the counter, and somebody famous like Dory Greenspan would have or Martha Stewart would have a selected collection of 15 or 20 recipes maximum, and you could go by, look at videos of every single step of that recipe. They didn't really do very well. So,
right, because they took too much time. I think, you know, we don't want to sit down and look at things for long. That's why your little videos are so great. I think people want to go, now, wait a minute, how do I do that again? And they just want to spend maybe 30 seconds understanding how it's supposed to look. Mm-hmm. And I think it's confidence building in a lot of ways. You're like, oh, like you say, visual learning. So I think that for a while, all the cookbook authors were like, oh, and we've got to have these little booklets along with our, you know, and I also think technology wasn't quite there then. Like now I can just like click over, look at how somebody's doing something and go, oh, this, like, I think somebody was saying, how do you, ask me how you tuck turkey wings under when you're cooking a turkey? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? And I was like, well, you know, you just kind of sort of break them a little and put them right under that part where and they were just lost. But if you look at it for 30 seconds and you're like, oh, just tuck the turkey wing under. But it's very hard to explain unless you can show somebody. So, I think that's why cooking classes are so popular and have been for a long time. And when you see somebody do something, then you're like, oh, okay, I can get that. But I don't want to spend a lot of time. I mean, I use little videos all the time when I'm trying to figure something out, and I just want to you know, I just need to see it just for a second. I don't even care so much, you know, what the source is. I just sort of Google around until I find, you know, what, you know, like, what is it, how is this supposed to come off the back of a spoon, or when, you know, these cooking phrases that a lot of us hear or throw around or write in our, you know, in our newspapers or whatever, that people just don't. You got to see it once, and then you figure it out. So I think it's changed a lot. And Bonnie, do you all spend a lot of money and time on those technique videos, or are they pretty easy to do?
Yeah, I think we're doing more and more of them. We're going to have a test kitchen when we're just a couple weeks away from moving into the new Washington Post headquarters, and we get to have a test kitchen for the first time. So it'll be really great, and it'll have a setup to do videos much snazzier than we have been doing, which is in our own homes, basically.
When you think about Tasty, are people actually making those recipes, or is it just a cool thing that you can watch for a minute?
I can really only say that people would be watching them, the people who are interested in making them. I mean, otherwise, there are lots of other ways to sort of look at food or go and eat it rather than watch food videos all day. I mean, it's kind of, you know.
I can tell you, people do make them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to a site like Reddit and you look at people posting those recipes from Tasty, the comments are full of pictures of people that people have done at home. Like, people are posting their own versions of it.
Yeah, they sort of tend to, like, share, and, you know, it's like the Pinterest Yumly thing, you know, look what I did to that recipe. So,
Kenji,
you know, one of the reasons I think those recipes are so popular, if you look at those videos, I would say at least 9 out of 10 of them, they end with a shot of somebody pulling away a string of melted cheese. And that's almost every one of those recipes. There's melted cheese pulling away in every single one of them, almost every single one of them.
All right, so speaking of melted cheese, Kenji, you've got your own story of a recipe going viral. Will you share it with us?
Pizza recipe. Yeah, it was similar to sort of a predecessor to one of those BuzzFeed recipes. You know, it was a recipe for a pan pizza, and it went viral. And I think the main reason it did was because it was completely visually presented. You know, it wasn't the recipe itself that went viral. It was the slideshow, the gallery of how to make it step by step. And it was one of these sort of really simple. You mix these ingredients together. Here's how you put them in the pan. This is how much it should spread. It's a very visual recipe, and it's one that doesn't require a lot of sort of intricate steps. And that's sort of the hallmark of one of those recipes, I think. But, you know, I wanted to go back to talk a bit about what Kim was saying. And we had this conversation maybe a month ago about other ways in which the internet has changed recipe writing. And I think a lot of it has to do with just what Kim was mentioning right now, is that you don't have to spend as much time on sort of basic instructions, that it's much easier to assume a certain level of knowledge of people, or to assume that they're going to be able to quickly look it up if they don't know what it is. So, you know, and if you think about it, it's sort of like if you're, you know, when you're in middle school and you're taking a math test, you're not allowed to use a calculator, because that's when you're learning how to do your addition and subtraction and all the basic functions. You know, but then when you go on to do more advanced math, you're allowed to use a calculator, and the calculator does all those basic steps for you so that you can go on to do more advanced stuff. And you know, I find the internet's to be sort of like the built-in, you know, calculator in that test for recipes, because when you don't know how to do something, you just look it up, you know. And not only that, but the internet also gives us a much broader window into food culture around the world, and techniques and ingredients from around the world. And so if you think back like 15 years ago, before the internet had really taken off, if you wanted to find a recipe for an authentic Sichuan dish for like Kung Pao chicken, your options were to buy one of a handful of books. You know, maybe you would go and buy Fuchsia Dunlop's book, and that would give you a good recipe because she'd been there and she'd seen it and she translated it for the home cook. These days, if you want to know how to make Kung Pao chicken, like, you can literally just go and find somebody who's in China right now taking a video of a chef making it. And that has completely changed the way that people, the level of people's interest in foods from around the world and techniques from around the world, and also the way in which people think about combining techniques and flavors. So, you know, the whole Korean taco thing, you can credit Roy Choi of the, you know, the Koji barbecue truck in L.A. of inventing the Korean taco, but he's definitely not what popularized the Korean taco. You know, what popularized the Korean taco was the internet, and the idea, you know, even the truck itself, you would follow its location on the internet, and it was sort of this, you know, public sleuthing game. game of where's the truck right now? And then once you found it, people would post pictures of the tacos they were eating. And that's what really made that style of recipe popular. It started with an innately good idea, but without the internet, it never would have taken off.
Kim Severson, speaking of styles of recipes that didn't used to exist, Bon Appetit magazine experimented recently with creating a recipe using emojis. Is there any sense, or is there going to be a sense, that things have kind of gone too far, that the concept of what a recipe is ultimately going to go back to its roots as simple step-by-step instructions?
Well, I think you just answered your question with the emoji recipe, but...
it was delicious.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm still like, what does FOMO mean? I don't even know. I think that we're seeing this pushing of form right now in lots of ways, and I think that that'll produce new and better ways, and there may be things that... recipes will strengthen because of some of the things we're learning. Maybe the way that, media is integrated into how we learn to cook, obviously that's changed a lot. But I still think at the end of the day, you need to know, do I need a teaspoon of baking soda or do I need a half a teaspoon of baking soda? And do I need to fold the eggs in at this point or at that point? And there will be people, there are many different kinds of cooks in the country, many different people who approach the kitchen in different ways. But I think at the end of the day, it's a formula, and you want to know how it works. You still need that framework and that structure, and I think that will just increasingly become more important. A really well-built recipe has a very good framework to it, and I can walk in and pick it up, and you can pick it up, and another person can pick it up. We may have varying results based on our skill level, but essentially we can recreate that dish and it'll be a training tool, and then you can, riff off and it'll just be, I know how to braise, I know the technique, I'm going to do 100 million things. But I think that basic framework, and we're finding that in lots of places, that, it may seem like we're blowing up all the forms, and that's true, but, when it comes down to it, a recipe is, it's a contract between you and whoever wrote it. It's something you're building something. I don't think they're going to come up with new ways to wire a house and make electricity. There's still electricity has to go from one point to another, and the light comes on. There's still that real basic framework to it. So I think we can play. I think it's a great time to be in working with the form of recipes. A great time to be playing around. Ton of people are cooking better. They're bringing new stuff to it every day. It's fantastic. But I do think at the end of the day, you need to know, is it a teaspoon of baking powder or a half a teaspoon? And when do I put it in the batter?
John in Falls Church, Virginia, has been holding for quite a while. And I suspect he has strong feelings on that, especially with regards to baking.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Hey, John.
First of all, thanks to Kenji for putting that book together. I've been looking for a resource. I work with a lot of youth groups, and it's very interesting. There's been this sort of generational gap. You've got teenagers now that are interested in learning these things, whereas their parents and in some cases their grandparents were part of the generation that got away from, a lot of home cooking. But with regards to baking, I think that's one place where you've got to be careful on people improvising, learning that from hard experience. But in other things, I've had friends that will be absolutely apoplectic if they don't, when they're measuring spices for a soup, that they need to level off the measuring spoon with the back of a knife. And I think one of the impediments to people trying new things has been this sort of mindset created by some of the cooking shows like the Iron Chefs and the Hell's Kitchen and things like that, where, it's just, it can seem somewhat intimidating. Now, on the other hand, those shows have when they go through sequences where someone is given, ingredients on the fly and they have to come up with something. I think that's very interesting. And that the one last thing I'll say is that, some of my best cooking has been the result of mistakes. One that comes to mind this time of year was I was going to make a pecan pie for Thanksgiving, and being inattentive, I grabbed the wrong bag from the shelf at the store, and when I got home, I found I had walnuts instead of pecans, didn't have time to go back, then proceeded to find out that I didn't have corn syrup. And I ended up using maple syrup, and I came up with a maple walnut pie that is now, I have to make it every Thanksgiving for the family, or it's not complete. So anyway, thanks again, Kenji. Look forward to reading your book.
Hey, Kenji, you don't write as much, I believe, about dessert. Is this one of the reasons
there's no dessert in the book at all. No, it's mainly just because I'm not a big dessert lover, and you know, I mean, writing that book was such a long project anyhow that if I wasn't passionate about every recipe in there, it just wasn't going to happen. So that was a decision I made at the beginning, that, you know, dessert was something that was just a little bit too difficult for me to try and tackle, just because I don't love it as much as regular cooking. But, you know, maybe in the future. But, you know, but Dave, when he called in, was exactly right about saying that you know, with baking and with certain key steps in regular savory cooking recipes, those are the times, you know, when measuring and being precise are quite important. But, you know, for a home cook, that, I mean, I think, you know, whether you have 3 grams of cinnamon or 7 grams of cinnamon in your apple pie, it largely comes down to a matter of taste. So for a lot of people, I think demystifying cooking has to do with knowing, you know, when it is important to measure and when it's not important to measure. And that's something that I think can take a little practice to learn, or a few good books to learn. You know, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, like Michael Ruhlman's book Ratio, back from, I think it was like 2009 or 2010. You know, that book is based on that very premise. You know, here are the important ingredients, and here's the ratios that they should be at, and here are the techniques to combine them. Everything else is really up to you and up to your personal taste. So knowing those things is part of what's going to make a recipe successful or not.
So I want to ask you a maybe less useful question about the science of cooking that you have studied. Can you tell us, I believe you've tackled this, why do onions make us cry? And what's the best way to prevent tears?
Well, onions make you cry. So the onion cells have chemical precursors in them that when you cut open those cells, they combine and they create these chemical compounds called lacrimators. And, you know, that comes from the Latin for tears. That's what makes you cry. So essentially, you know, the more cells you rupture, the more lacrimators are created and the more you're going to cry. Part of it, the direction that you're cutting the onion can make a difference. If you slice them orbitally, that is like sort of perpendicular to, you know, between the base and the tip, you end up rupturing more cells than if you slice them pole to pole, which can also affect the flavor. Onions sliced orbitally are a little more pungent than onions cut pole to pole. The temperature can affect it as well, because the warmer they are, the more volatile those compounds are going to be. So a colder onion will make you cry less. But at the end of the day, you know, really the only way to completely prevent yourself from crying is to cover up your eyes. So either with goggles, if you wear contact lenses, I can tell you contact lens wearers will know this, that they completely protect your eyes. So you can cut as many onions as you want while you're wearing contacts and they won't hurt you. But, you know, goggles are the only real thing. You know, chewing bread or lighting a candle or any of those other tricks don't actually work.
Well, look at the big brain on you, young man.
I don't wear goggles. Do you wear goggles, Kim?
No, I just muffle through. I use it as a chance to purge some of my, you know, emotional baggage and cry.
The tears actually help the food. Yeah. It's that je ne sais quoi that we put into
I do think a sharp knife, and I try to kind of, you know, just. But it's so interesting that I did not realize that. You know, if you cut it on the equator versus, you know, root to tail, that it's going to be stronger that way. I learned something today. I love this. Isn't this awesome?
I bet you, if it's not already out there by next year at this time, someone will have invented a high-end, or someone will be marketing a high-end pair of kitchen goggles.
Oh, they're out. They've been out.
See, I know. I was going to make a fortune. About, like, processing your emotional stuff through onion, cutting onions, and, like, do kind of a cookbook and a self-improvement, self-help book combined into one. I think I'm on to the next bestseller here.
Well, Kim Severson is the Atlanta bureau chief at the New York Times. She is the author of a really cool new article about how cookbooks, just like everything else, are being disrupted here in the 21st century. Kenji Lopez-Alt, the managing culinary director at Sirius Eats and the author of The Food Lab, is an example of that disruption. And Bonnie Benwick is the deputy editor and recipe editor at the Washington Post food section. I'm Michael Schaefer, sitting in on the Kojo Namdi show. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.